So welcome back to the IBD podcast series for primary care. My name's Charlie Andrews, a GP, and I'd like to thank Crohn's and Colitis once again for making this podcast series possible. The aim of this series is to bring you expert advice from experts in different areas of inflammatory bowel disease. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Anthony Wiskin, who's a paediatric gastroenterologist at Bristol Children's Hospital. So thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Charlie.
Obviously, this is a huge thing. So a significant number of IBD diagnoses are made in children. Could you tell us a bit about the type of disease that you tend to find in children and what sort of ages we tend to pick it up in?
Yeah. So, I mean, the data that are out there tell us that about 25% of all inflammatory bowel disease starts off in childhood. And the typical thing that you might see is going to be a teenager who has got symptoms consistent with inflammatory bowel disease. But we are seeing it in other people at sort of younger age groups. So it is very unusual, but you do see it in children under four. Whether it turns out to be Crohn's disease, whether it turns out to be ulcerative colitis, younger children with inflammatory bowel disease will almost universally have bloody diarrhoea and frank colitis as a presenting problem.
So in that very young age, we tend to see quite florid symptoms. So that's quite helpful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in children, is the disease more aggressive? How does it tend to progress for children?
Yeah, and again, I think the different ages, the different phenotypes probably reflect slightly different things. So where we say inflammatory bowel disease can occur in children less than two, actually what we're talking about is an inflammatory bowel disease-like illness, because there'll be a proportion of those where actually it's a single gene defect, or you know, the likelihood of it being a more monogenic disease is greater the younger you are. So we will screen lots of these young children for things like an IL-10 receptor defect or other things like that that have got a different disease pathway, but actually might be modified by different treatments. As you go sort of through the age ranges, then the phenotype is more similar to what you get with adult disease. But I think that the severity of the disease, it does tend to be a more severe disease. Now, you could argue, well, you're saying that as a paediatrician and you don't see the adults, and that is, you know, totally fair. But it's not uncommon that we're handing children over to adult services having got through most of the drugs that are available.
That's interesting. And if we're looking now a bit more at diagnosis, you mentioned there about the under twos and there seems to be a certain pattern there, but can you give GPs some advice about what types of presentations we might be looking for in children?
Yeah. What I sort of say to families and medical students and anyone really about it is to think about where the disease might be and what the symptoms might be associated with it. So if it's colitis, be it Crohn's disease colitis or be it ulcerative colitis, then the symptoms are going to be fairly similar. And that is, it's going to be, you know, bloody, frequent, loose stools. One of the sort of discerning questions about that is, in terms of severity, is that happening at night? Because that's not something that's readily asked. And associated with that is the sense of urgency and is associated sort of pain, often on the left side low down, that takes a bit of time to be got rid of once they've been and opened their bowels. And often even the sort of stubbornest male teenager will, after a period of time, tell their parents that this is going on. Now that period of time, maybe, I remember one child who presented with an hemoglobin of 4 because he collapsed on his paper round because he was a sort of strapping 15-year-old lad and he wasn't going to tell anyone about it. But usually, you know, the colitis patients you will pick up within a few weeks of symptom onset, and I think those are referred in fairly quickly because it's clearly abnormal. I think again the upper GI tract, symptoms of nausea, of being sick, of sort of epigastric pain, those are very common symptoms, particularly in adolescence, particularly sort of associated with stress, and you may look for other things like headaches and things. So they can be very vague and they're certainly not specific for inflammatory bowel disease. the things you start to look for around that is, well, are there other sort of upper GI things? So have they got mouth ulcers? Have they got those sort of swollen lips that you see? So sometimes simply a sort of thickened bottom lip is an indicator that this could be sort of oral Crohn's disease, maybe with some perioral erythema around it. So it can be a bit vague. Even vaguer is the child who's got, you know, ileitis. And more often in paediatrics than in adults, kids with Crohn's disease will have sort of an ileocolonic phenotype. But actually, it's often the end of the small bowel and just the cecum. And the symptoms can be quite vague. And so there can be symptoms of a bit of tummy ache, fatigue. How do you judge fatigue in a teenager? And anemia. So it can be really difficult to pick up. And sometimes what you see is that actually you don't see weight loss, but you see that actually children are getting slimmer as they get taller. You can get growth arrest as well. So there are children who have got very little in the way of gut symptoms at all, who simply have got delayed height velocity. It's not that unusual that you get a referral that's come through endocrine clinic where they go, well, look, we've given them growth hormone, they still haven't grown. Could this be something? And you go hunting for the Crohn's, really. You might have something as little as like a slightly raised ESR to point to. So that growth arrest can be quite traumatic. Sometimes it's the sort of thing that parents don't pick up on. They kick themselves afterwards because they go, I didn't really see this, because it's so insidious. And so it's people that don't see them as often. Grandparents look at them and go, instead of going, oh my, you're getting bigger, Jimmy, they're like, hang on a second, what's going on there?
I'm going to bring you back to that bit about children not really wanting to present to anyone with bleeding, etc. I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis when I was 14, and I'd had bleeding for a couple of years, and you just don't really want to tell anyone at that age, and it does take time to get to that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And also that issue around parents feeling guilty sometimes, or feeling really worried, understandably, about this sort of situation. I suspect that you come across that quite a lot with parents, and it must be really difficult to manage that and help them manage some of that, those feelings and anxieties.
Yeah, I think particularly around that that sort of junior school age, I suppose, where, you know, sort of tummy aches and those sorts of things are quite common, and lots of parents are doing the perfectly sensible things of going, yeah, it'll be all right, get off to school, I'm sure it'll be better when you get to school. I think families do feel absolutely awful when you go, well, yeah, this is it. And often they'll ask, well, how long has this been going on for? Sometimes you're looking at, you know, fairly cobblestone small bowel, and you're like, well, this hasn't happened overnight. You know, this has been going on for months. It is really difficult. But, you know, parents, even if they're doctors, you know, they're not looking out for this. You know, I don't think most people are looking out for this. You're going to default to thinking actually your child is well, usually.
Yeah. And it must be really hard, because to see your child unwell must be really difficult for these people. I remember when I was unwell, my parents really suffered, because it's awful to see your child losing weight, very unwell, not able to go to school and things. Do you see quite a lot of that? And how do you support parents and families?
Yeah, I think it is very, very difficult. So we have, you know, within our team, there's a lot that we all sort of do as, you know, consultants, in terms of actually trying to reassure people that actually this isn't anyone's fault, this is rotten luck, it is just, you know, it's one of those things, and actually acknowledging that this is horrible, you know, it's a horrible disease, and that it doesn't have to always be thus, and actually that there is hope, and that, you know, there are many people in all sorts of walks of life that have got this condition that have gone on to do great things. In terms of sort of supporting people specifically in difficulties, our nurse specialists do a good job of sort of going through some of that sort of early communication around stuff. And we've got really lucky that we've got psychologists embedded in our team. What we're trying to do is to provide workshops for kids to think about things that, you know, they perhaps wouldn't normally get the opportunity to do in groups of children that have got inflammatory bowel disease. So thinking about things like exam stress and stuff like that, but actually how is that different if you've got inflammatory bowel disease? And looking at coping skills, because there's a lot that the kids themselves have to cope with. as teenagers anyway, and then you throw in a thing of being different a little bit, which no teenager wants to be. And so we're trying to do sort of preventative work there, rather than actually using our psychologists all the time as rescue when someone's actually got in a real heap.
Yeah, it's a big thing for a kid, so it's great that there's that support, that peer support, I think, is really important as well, isn't it? And it sounds like you utilise that. You mentioned there about your team a little bit, and I just wanted to ask a little bit more, because you said that you have a nurse specialist. Is that well placed around the country? Do most departments have a nurse specialist to support?
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah, the challenge of paediatric gastroenterology compared to adult gastroenterology is that, you know, we offer very much a regional service. So here in Bristol, we serve 10 hospitals, and we're a slight victim of geography where we are, because we cover all the way down to the end of Cornwall. And so that means, you know, patients are travelling up to 4 hours to come and see us to have an endoscopy, to come for outpatient appointments. We do regional clinics, but they only happen, you know, 4 or 5 times a year. And so that means that all of the expertise is really centred in Bristol. So our nurse specialists are in Bristol. It is really difficult to get the team to where the families are. But it is a real challenge of, well, you know, if people need to get some psychology input, but that is not available in the local hospitals, so then they're having to travel, you know. And so we're trying to look at not doing everything in Bristol, putting workshops on in, you know, Taunton or Exeter or somewhere that's sort of relatively in the middle of the patch. But it is a particular challenge of paediatric gastroenterology is getting stuff to where people need it. And, you know, the impact on the family is enormous, because actually, you know, there are quite a lot of families who actually both parents want to be able to come to the appointments. They want to be able to come to all of the things with their children. And, you know, the effect of time off work and all the rest of it is massive.
Yeah. And do you have dietitians in your team as well? Yeah, you do. I just recall that, you know, a parent spoke to me and was really worried about what they should allow their child to eat or what not to eat. And I know that diet is a huge thing that people with IBD are very understandably interested in. So do you get a lot of people wanting to know more about what to eat, what I shouldn't eat?
You know, it's one of the first questions, I think, that, you know, when it's initially sunk in, right, it's inflammatory bowel disease, I think people go away, they have a thing, and they come back and go, right, well, what in my diet do I need to change, you know? And it's an obvious thing, and I think the, you know, what we talk through is about, well, why has inflammatory bowel disease happened? And we talk about the fact that, you know, there is a genetic tendency to it. So there's, I don't know, maybe nearly 200 genes involved in the etiology of inflammatory bowel disease. A lot of those are to do with how the immune system functions. And that we think that, you know, the triggers are something to do with the interactions between the immune system and the gut microbiome. And then the question is, well, you know, the gut microbiome, is it disturbed in some way as part of our westernized lifestyle? Because we know that inflammatory bowel disease is more common in developed countries. And although the incidence perhaps has peaked, it's been increasing over the last sort of couple of decades. And so the natural sort of consequence of that is, well, is it the diet that's altering the flora that's therefore affecting the immune system? And, you know, there are no good data to be able to point at particular things. Lots of people have tried. And one of the things that I share, because our particular interest is in nutrition, but one of the things I share with families is that the research is inherently biased, because there's an industry to support drugs, there isn't an industry to support, you know, food particularly. And studies are very messy as soon as you start looking at diet and food. So there isn't anything clear that we can go, right, this is what you should or what you shouldn't eat. I was actually part of the ESPEN guideline group that seemed to take forever to produce its sort of its guidance, which doesn't really show any clear pointers. It goes through a lot of data. And obviously, if you type in diet and IBD in Google, you get a huge amount out. And, you know, some of those are anecdotal experiences of people who, you know, claim that their inflammatory bowel disease is cured. And some of those people you meet and you think they look really well, and other people you meet and you go, well, what do you eat? And, well, it's all pureed. Well, that's because you've got a stricture that isn't actually, you know, managed. So some of that is really difficult. But there are, you know, there are a number of really promising sort of dietary interventions that we've seen, particularly in paediatric IBD recently. So There's a group in Israel that have only published disappointingly short-term results about inducing remission in Crohn's with a combination of liquid diet and food. And then a team in Glasgow that have, their diet looks completely different to the Israel group, but have again, very small numbers have shown diet can induce remission. But clearly what we all want to know is about remission induction. Perhaps isn't that difficult, but actually sustaining remission is the key. And yeah, I mean, there's lots of really interesting pointers from, you know, countries like Japan and how their country developed, how inflammatory bowel disease developed, and massive changes in diet that happened, but nothing to really pinpoint what it's all about.
It's certainly quite a grey area at the moment. And, you know, because I spoke to Sam Poor, who's a dietitian, I spoke to him on our one of the episodes, and we were talking about how it's so important just to have a really varied diet and try and make sure that, you know, you're getting all of those different food groups in and to get dietary advice if you are thinking of following a restricted diet.
Yes,
was kind of where we were, what we were looking at that point.
And I think that if you, you know, if you have a fairly sort of common sense approach to it and go, well, you know, if the microbiome is part of it, what do we know about a disordered microbiome? Well, it's a decrease in the sort of numbers of different species there. So how, what can you do to increase that variety is eating a broad range of foods.
I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on faecal calprotectin in children. So we've got nice diagnostic guideline 11, which tells us 18 plus, we can use faecal calprotectin to help us differentiate IBS and IBD. What role does it play in your opinion, in paediatric situations?
Yeah, and it's a, I mean, it's a really interesting question, and you know, it depends who you ask, I think, is the answers that you get. So, I mean, we get a number of referrals that come through to paediatrics where a calprotectin test has been done, and that has been part of the influence that's made the GP sort of refer for a paediatric or paediatric gastroenterology opinion. And I think there is a real need for some clearer guidance as to when or when isn't that appropriate. So we know that the normal ranges that exist for calprotectin in adult, well, the industry will sort of say a cutoff of 50 because that's how their sort of cutoffs are made. But actually in practice, we know that sort of a cutoff of 200 is likely to be sort of more discerning for inflammatory bowel disease or somewhere between the two. But then in paediatrics, we know that actually calprotectin does vary considerably across the age range. I'm not quite sure why. I mean, it's really interesting, but certainly under four, and as you get sort of closer to birth, then calprotectin is significantly raised. And is that reflective of microbiology that's going on and immunological priming that's happening as part of that? Who knows? Fascinating. And again, you know, some massive data from China where they've shown that actually in infants, calprotectin is significantly different between those in rural areas and those in urban areas. What's going on there? Fascinating. But it means that the cutoffs that we have are not applicable for children. And it's not uncommon, maybe once a month, that we'll get a referral that comes through that says, mum or dad's got inflammatory bowel disease, and they've requested a faecal calprotectin on their infant, who's often under 6 months. It's elevated. Can you see if they've got inflammatory bowel disease? Now, of course, we will see that parent because actually they are absolutely terrified that their child's got inflammatory bowel disease, and it's the right thing to do to be able to counsel them properly and go, this isn't. But actually we could have prevented all that anxiety of actually them now knowing they've got a positive test, thinking their child's going to go through all the hell that they've gone through, then to undo that. And it's where the phenotypes of inflammatory bowel disease are really important. You know, so actually children under four, they're going to have colitis. You're not going to miss it. So you don't need to do a calprotectin. You don't need to do a calprotectin if a child's got bloody diarrhea, because that alone, if someone has got frequent bloody diarrhea and it's not infective, we don't need a calprotectin to influence whether we're going to do an endoscopy. We're interested in a calprotectin in trying to discern out, well, what some of these, you know, vaguer symptoms and some of these non-specific symptoms that we have. So these tummy aches, nauseas, things that are just not as clear cut. That's when a calprotectin is more useful. And I think it has to be in those sort of older patients. And we have had a lot of conversation with our general paediatric colleagues who are feeling that the number of referrals coming through with borderline calprotectin results, so 80, 120 sort of numbers, is having a significant effect on their workload. So over actually the last 2 years, we've done a couple of projects looking at this, and we have seen that the number of referrals has gone up by about sort of 54%. And that the primary reason when you look through the referrals is about the care protective. Now, a lot of the secondary care paediatricians are saying, well, we should just throw out care protective because actually it's just generating loads of referrals. And what we've seen from the data is actually a large number of care protectives are being done and are negative and are seemingly being reassuring because those patients are not getting referred. So I think it is a really, it is a useful tool. I think it has a role to go, actually, no, this isn't inflammatory bowel disease. We're okay with this. This is functional, or it's anxiety, or it's whatever it is. But I think there is a need to work out a clearer pathway of what do we do with these borderline care protectives. So we do see that a number of them will be up for some reason, and if you repeated it a month later, they would settle down again. And that is unlikely to be a child with inflammatory bowel disease. What we're keen to do is sort of try and work out with our own data, right, what's a valid pathway, and then to sort of ensure prospectively that that doesn't miss any patients and then roll it out. And we're sort of at an early stage of that at the moment.
Oh, that sounds exciting and sounds really good. Yeah. Moving on to management.
Yeah.
I've talked about flare management on the podcast before with Dr. Kevin Barrett, and we were talking about adult management. Are there differences between the management of a child to the management of an adult? How does that alter? How does that change?
I could talk all day about that. I mean, I think there's many sort of essential components of paediatrics that mean it's a very different thing. You know, you're managing the child, and you know, one of the great things about paediatrics is the child always comes with an advocate who can be a very strong voice, and so you're managing the parent alongside that. So that aside, then you're thinking about, okay, well, what's going to be the options in terms of management? So for ulcerative colitis, the treatment pathway is fairly similar. So it's aminosalicylates, it's prednisolone, and if that's not working, it's moving on to biologic therapies. In Crohn's disease, there is the primary disease treatment is liquid diet therapy. And you know, this isn't something that is widely used within adult gastroenterology. In paediatrics, the meta-analysis would say it's equivalent to steroids. Probably it's better, because there's some individual studies that look at actual mucosal healing, which is the target we're all aiming for these days, which show that actually liquid diet is much better at obtaining that than steroids is. And, you know, it is remarkable. It's the thing that got me into paediatric gastroenterology, to be honest, was, you know, as an SHO, going around seeing kids that were on liquid diet therapy and going, what the heck is going on? How is this inducing a mucosal remission? And the key to its success, I think, is priming people with what you expect to happen, and acknowledging that it's hard, but that actually it's worth it. So there are different units around the country that use different things. So in the units that I've worked in, an NG tube has very rarely needed to be used for liquid diet therapy. Kids drink it. And the reason they drink it is because they feel better, and you give them the time scale of what they expect. So, you know, we know that it might take a couple of days for them to get up to drinking the full amount that they need. And that's because often by the time they get to see us, they're not really interested in food. Their satiety is, you know, really poor. They feel full up so quickly that actually they can't get the right amount of nutrition in. But they can slowly build that up over a few days. And then you say, actually, within a week, you'll be feeling better, and what you'll be feeling is more energy. And they do see that. And then you sort of say, well, look, your tummy aches will still be there, but they'll get a bit less. And your stooling frequency will go down. And then the last thing to go will be the blood. Now, often the blood is the sort of almost the alarm thing that everyone's worried about, and actually often that's the thing they think is going to get better first, and you have to explain that's the thing that's going to go away last. And so understanding that this is the sequence of events, this is how I know it's working, then that gets the engagement of the family going, okay, this therapy is working. And we also make sure we review them very quickly. So you know, we'll see people at diagnosis, we'll see them again within 2 weeks. If things aren't working, we'll be changing things, because you know, it's not fair to have someone stuck on a liquid diet therapy if it's not working. And equally, you need to make sure that they're getting what they need, because you're prescribing all their nutrition as well. So we know that for sort of 70-80% of children, that will be effective as their primary therapy. And the treatment length varies. The randomised data, the data that are out there are sort of quite random as to the length. Some say 4 weeks, some say 8 weeks, some say 10 weeks, some say 12. And pragmatically, I think everyone's hit on around 6 to 8 weeks. And that seems to be a good balance between how sustainable it is versus achieving remission. I mean, it's obviously got something to do with the anti-inflammatory properties that liquid diet seems to have. You know, one of the questions is, what does it need to be? Obviously, Nestlé make Modulin, which is the feed of choice because it's, you know, what we've got. But around the world, people use different things, and you could probably use anything that is labelled as nutritionally complete, and it would produce the same thing. And then you do think, well, why don't we use that in adults? You know, because actually, there's plenty of nutritionally complete feeds that could be used in adults. And I think, you know, sometimes it is used, particularly when you've had every biologic and you're really screwed and what else are you going to do? But I think part of it is that actually the adults are, they've had far more life experience. They often need cups of tea and coffee in the morning. And they haven't got necessarily a family around them that's able to support them in the same way. They are the support for the rest of their family sometimes. So, you know, the kids who are doing it are well supported, they're well distracted, they go off to school, they take the Modulin with them. And families manage it differently about, you know, how are we going to do mealtimes. There are some families who will, you know, literally lock themselves away and be sort of scuffing their food in turn in the kitchen so that the child doesn't have to see them eating. And other families who just embrace it and go, look, this is what it is, you have that, we have that, it's not for long, we'll just do it. So I think that's the biggest difference that we have. Otherwise, as part of primary treatment, we'll use steroids for Crohn's disease and we'll use biologics. And I think that, you know, biologics have been the game changer in pediatrics, or they have been in adult care. We are using them increasingly and earlier. So there are children at diagnosis where we will sort of do some combination of Modulin and biologics, because we know that, you know, steroids are not going to really cut the mustard. Now, that's probably not entirely consistent with the NICE guidelines, but I think that's practice that's happening, you know, up and down the country. Because you could go through steroids, azathioprine, steroids, oh, it's still not working, give them some infliximab, and you're a year down the line. You know, and the same debates are there in paediatrics with, you know, step up, top down, is that the way around? Yeah, but anyway, the same debates are there in paediatrics as well as adults.
Yeah, I think it's amazing that we've got this dietary intervention that's so effective in children, because, you know, as a GP, I feel quite wary about giving a child 8 weeks of steroids, for example, and all the side effects, etc., that comes with. Do you see many side effects from long-term steroids in these children?
Yeah, I mean, we'd be very clear to go, we're not using sort of steroids long term, but a course of steroids will be 10, 12 weeks. And yes, in that time, there will be changes in facial appearance, particularly teenagers. There will be spots. There will be even worse mood swings that teenagers suffer. There will be sleep disturbance. All of those things happen. And, you know, again, we prime them for it. So, you know, we'll explain all those things. We'll say, make sure you take it in the morning, otherwise you'll be up all night. All of those things happen. And again, I think it is better managed if you preempt it by explaining this is what's going to happen. But the key thing, we don't want people on long-term steroids, and we use steroid-sparing strategies and perhaps more aggressive with the use of biologics, is around growth. You know, that if you've got somebody who is presenting at, you know, 13, 14, who has got growth delay, who is, you know, in the early stages of puberty, and then you don't really want to be giving them courses of steroids. You want to be giving them a therapy that is going to allow them to continue to grow, and if possible catch up with where they should be, because their height velocity has been poor. And so, yeah, there's a real key for, you know, Modulin and biologics. You know, I've seen some kids who've presented to paediatric services aged 17, 18, who've been the size of 12-year-olds, where we've gone, actually, look, you have got a very narrow window left of growth, but you haven't completed puberty. So let's go. Modulin, biologics, and height velocities that are just astronomical. And some of those kids continue to grow through, you know, into their 20s. And you know, the consequences for some of those kids, I particularly think one kid, and he was out of school at an early age because actually school was miserable for him because he was small. He was a bright lad, but you can't help think that his future would have been a bit different if it had been picked up earlier.
Yeah, that's really important. So at transition, so there's this thing called transition, which I don't know if all GPs will know about, but could you talk a bit about transition, how it works and how you support people through that?
Yeah, I think so. The key thing about transition is that you start off with a child with inflammatory bowel disease and say they're 11 or 12. Well, you're giving them information about their diagnosis when they're 11 or 12, hopefully in a way that they're grasping it, and that's fine. But what then happens over the next few years as they move to a young person through to an adult is that they have to take all of that on themselves, whereas initially their parents have taken most of it on. And so there's this shift in what is known, what needs to be known, and in ownership of the condition that needs to occur in order for there to be a successful transition. And so a successful transition is where the young person has all the knowledge, all the tools that they need to know about managing their own condition. They can do that independently without their parents. And so, you know, one of the questions always asked about the time of transition. Clearly, if you have at the outset, well, that's what a successful transition looks like, then that's going to be different for different people. And so services need to be able to reflect that. I mean, there are some centres that have got, you know, young person clinics where actually all patients between the ages of 16 and 25 will come to the same clinic and they'll be looked after by both a paediatrician and an adult physician. There's lots of different frameworks. One that's been adopted sort of fairly universally across the country is something called Ready Steady Go that was developed by the renal team in Southampton. And so what that does is that gives a framework to transition. So it works on a series of questionnaires that are given to the children and their families to try and work out, right, these are all the areas that need to be covered, which do you feel comfortable in, which do you need some help with. And so part of our specialist nursing role is to be able to actually take those questionnaires, sit down with the kids and go, right, you know, this is what you need to know. We're rubbish at talking to teenagers about sex, about drugs, about smoking, about alcohol, but it's clearly really important. And so, you know, we need to try and find the time in our clinics to deal with those sorts of issues. And more importantly, to answer the questions that they come up with, rather than us telling them what they think we need, you know, what we think they need to know, and actually answering their questions, because some people have such misplaced ideas about these things that they need to be straightened out. And the key in that is parents being able to, you know, relinquish control a little bit. There's a difference as well between, you know, paediatric services and adult services. So within paediatrics, children with inflammatory bowel disease will be seen every 3, 4, 6 months. That's a lot of appointments. So particularly if someone's, you know, diagnosed age 7 or something, then the families do get, we become part of the family and we're quite privileged in that. So a bit of a dependence does grow, and that's really hard. There's always lots of tears from families at transition appointments. But then the adult service is slightly different, because the reason we see people so frequently is because we're so obsessed with making sure that children grow properly and are developing and are not running into problems. In the adult world, it's very much the ownership is on the individual patient to let them know if there's a problem, and so people won't be seen so frequently. They will be given the nurse line and will be expected to call up if there's a problem. And sure, things will be checked up to make sure that repeat prescriptions can be done and all the rest of it. But it's a very different feeling, and that's really scary for families. Particularly, you know, knowing that actually their slightly irresponsible teenager is now the person that's got to make the phone call. And actually, they won't be able to talk to the adult team unless their son or daughter gives them, you know, their permission to do so. And even then, the adult team is probably not particularly going to want to hear what they say. They're going to go, well, what does the patient say? So it's a really difficult time. We know that if it's not done right, it's a disaster, you know. And we see that you know, there are data out there from all sorts of different conditions that, you know, say that if it isn't managed adequately, then children drop out of the system and their outcomes are worse. So it's really critical.
So it sounds like alongside managing their disease, you're also giving them some resources to take forwards when they move from, you know, what is potentially quite a protected environment into the adult services, which is more onus on them. So that's a really big, that's a big job that your team have got.
Yeah, you have to. And I think, because the thing is, you know, sometimes by the time they get to sort of 15, 16, you ask kids, what do you know is wrong with them? They're like, I don't know, actually. Oh, come on, were you not listening to any of it? But it's really important not to assume that they know, because they might not do. It's really important. They've got to be able to manage as an adult, knowing what they need to know.
And have you seen some of there are some apps out there and things that, I don't know if children are more sort of engaged in using apps and things. Have you come across those?
Yeah, we don't use a lot. I'm sure there are centres that are. And I think, yes, there's lots of sort of My IBD type apps that are really good at symptom trackers. And yeah, and there are some departments that have, you know, got the infrastructure to be able to integrate those into their clinic, which, I mean, is brilliant. You know, the fact that you could just have some sort of, you know, workspace thing where everything pops up and tells you how everyone's doing. And clearly some of those sort of almost crowd data, I think they're going to be the future. Yes, more and more kids have got mobile phones, and, you know, certainly most teenagers have. And I don't think we're very good in our unit at using them as perhaps we could do.
Okay. We're going to round up a little bit here, but I'm going to ask you that really big question now that GPs are going to want to know. How can we work better? How would you like us to communicate with you? What do you think our role is as GPs in this paediatric population with IBD? Do you have some advice for us?
Yeah, I think the key thing is we want to know. And so if you think you've got a child with inflammatory bowel disease, we want to know. If you've got a child that's got inflammatory bowel disease that's coming in with what looks like a flare-up, we want to know. You know, the last thing that we want to happen, and this does happen on rare occasions, is that we find that actually someone slipped out from follow-up a little bit, but actually when they come back to see us, they've had three courses of steroids from their GP. And you're like, what? That's not what we would have done, you know? So, you know, certainly don't act single-handedly about these children. And it may well be that you might phone up and get told, no, that sounds fine, do give a course of steroids. I haven't had one before. Let's see what happens. But the real thing is, you know, we do want to know. And that's why we do hopefully keep a really close eye on these kids. And we want to be involved in what's going on with them.
And how should we let you know? What's your, in this area, for example, how do you recommend we get in touch? And
yeah, I mean, certainly we have, you know, there's two easy ways. One is the nurse specialist. The other is that on our letterheads, there's the numbers for our secretaries. Just phone us up. We have a message book. We might not get back to you immediately, but we will get back to you. If the families haven't told us, we'll be a bit cross with them because we're like, I don't know what you should do. We tell all the families to call us if they've got problems. But definitely do call us. There are some sticky points which are always a bit difficult to negotiate, which is things like azathioprine, the monitoring thereof, the ongoing prescription, lots of most medications that we use in children, they're not licensed, they're going to be orange or red on a formulary, and that's something that we're used to, that's part of being a paediatrician, and we clearly can't sort of force that all on general practice. But it is difficult with, you know, things like bowel prep for endoscopy or azathioprine. If we've got someone who's in Yeovil who's saying, right, well, I need a prescription, and we can't issue a prescription in Yeovil, we can do one in Bristol, but they're not going to drive to Bristol for it. So it's that sort of common sense bit with trying to work out, okay, what are we going to do with prescriptions? The initial monitoring for azathioprine, we do the initial sort of couple of sets of blood tests the first month here, but then we're keen to move that back to general practice, and we've got, you know, we produce guidance as to this is the set of, you know, what to do. If the results are outside of this range, then do again get in touch. And some GPs are understandably more comfortable and better than others. I think the key thing is to get in touch, you know.
Yeah, good. So, like most messages I've had on the podcast so far, it's we need to work together.
Yeah.
And discuss things with each other. Thank you so much for that. That's really helpful stuff, Dr. Wiskin. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that our listeners have found this really useful. I've found it really helpful for my learning and my point of view. So thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.